Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. I'm a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech. If you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 42. Now, do you know that those TIFF files, tagged image file format files, you know, the second 16-bit word of every file is 42. It's an arbitrary, but it's carefully chosen number which identifies the file as a TIFF file. Also, you probably know this, but the password expiration policy for Microsoft Windows domain defaults to 42 days. Hmm. M42 is more known as the Orion Nebula. And if you've got a good eye of sight, or you've got a good dark sky, you can actually see the Orion Nebula with the naked eye.
I saw it through binoculars quite a few months ago during the last lunar eclipse.
All right, yeah.
It's quite green. It's green.
Yeah. Don't forget level 42.
Who could forget level 42?
From the 80s-ish. and also, have you heard of the gravity train? This is a theoretical idea that if you were to, it's an idea of continental travel, whereby it's theoretical. If you drill a hole from one place in the world to another place in the world, it could be anywhere. Let's just say England to Australia, for example. And then if you had a big tube going through the entire width of the Earth, and then you took all the air out of that, so it became a vacuum. And if you were to then sit inside some kind of capsule inside this tube, and say in England somewhere, and it dropped you, right? You'd obviously fall straight down, and you'd accelerate at the speed of gravity all the way until you reached the middle of the Earth. And then when you're coming up the other way, gravity is then slowing down, and you would actually stop at exactly the same point above sea level than when you started from in the first place. And that trip would actually take 42 minutes. And it doesn't matter where in the world you're starting and where in the world you're going to. If you're going straight through the middle, you'll fall faster.
Yep, you have to go through the center of the Earth.
This is why it's theoretical. Because you'd probably burn up or melt in the process.
I think the remake of Total Recall.
Oh, yeah.
The remake of Total Recall, that is a plot point, didn't it, I think?
Oh, right. I haven't seen the remake of it.
I have to say I fell asleep when it was on. I don't know if that's a casting aspersion on the film, but apparently that's part of the plot.
Yeah, well, that's what they're saying. So the 42 minutes is, if you were to go to a different place and it was at a lower angle, you would obviously fall slower and slow down slower in the tube, but it would still take 42 minutes. So you could go anywhere in the world in 42 minutes, basically. And then, of course, don't forget, 42 is the answer to life, the universe, and podcasts, because this is episode 42. But so what's everyone been up to in the past 42 days? No, it hasn't been that long, has it? What's everyone been up to since the last episode then?
Busy. Busy. I think 13th of I don't know. We put the post. Hang on, have I got any feedback? Sorry, I can just hear myself talking. That's all.
No, not here now.
Okay, good. That's better. Anyway, yeah. Well, I think we said we would record pod on the 13th, and then after that, we didn't. Eric just got mad and didn't release the podcast. I think it's like this week I released it, so it might have been a couple of. I might have been about so many days. Yeah, I've been busy. I mean, I've had such a busy week on with work-wise. I have been on site quite a lot, so I'll go through a couple of my stories. When we get one of our customers phone up, we get alerts if their server's been offline, and their server had been offline since Sunday afternoon. And they, looking at the logs, we couldn't connect to their firewall, or they couldn't. We couldn't see anything in their on their network, and they couldn't get out onto the internet. So, one of the second nine engineers spent a couple of hours trying to figure it out, trying to work out what it is. So I said, well, in the end, we might as well go back there, because it sounds like it's a firewall what's gone down, because we could connect to the router. So they had a Zyzl firewall, and on that Zyzl they had two ADSL connections. And on those ADSL connections, we could connect to the routers on the ADSL, but we couldn't get any internet access or actually log on to the routers to find anything out. So I went to site, and when I got there, the switch was off on. Could talk locally, but I couldn't ping the firewall, and the firewall had a red light on it, on the power. And on, if you read online, it says there's a hardware fault on it. So this firewall was out of date, or not out of date, it was out of warranty. So I took a spare bargle with me and got that up and running again. Really, it was quite interesting. they've been sold two separate broadband connections. So one is annoying, really annoying, because they were both double natting. So, which I really hate. So, because that double natting where you've got a, so like you've got one IP address, like most home routers right now, my home router, I've got one IP address, public IP address. And then behind that, you've got your internal IP address, your 192.168 address or whatever. And but again, behind that, they then had another firewall, and then they had their internal network. And, and sometimes when you do double natting, I talked about it before, is that it seems can get lost in transaction. So what I did in the end was we put the Vargor up, and the Vargor comes with a built-in ADSL. So I basically put one ADSL cable in the modem, in directly into the Vargor, and that got, so get, so the static IP address what that provider gave it went straight onto the firewall. Mm-hmm. So, and then obviously I had a second ADSL, but on the Vargor they don't have two ADSL cables. You have a WAN 2 port, and that WAN 2 port is an Ethernet connection, but that can also be a PPOE port. So what you can do is, if you get like a, I can't remember the name of the router, what, probably it might even be another size of router, but what you can do is you can configure that as a PPOE modem. So you basically log on to it and you turn it into a bridge router. So what happens is that basically does a syncing to the ADSL connection, and then the pass through of the username and password bit is done on the Vargor. So you still have the Cat5 cable from the ADSL router, the little ADSL router, but it puts it in the bridge mode, and then that then goes into the WAN 2 port, and then you configure that WAN 2 port as a PPOE, and that basically gives the public IP address on the actual Vargor. So that then got two public IP addresses, and then on the Vargor you can then do all your routing. So you can say you can have failover, or if you want to go to this IP address, you go down this tunnel, this ADSL connection. If you want to go down this IP address, go down this connection. So yeah, it was. But oddly, I was talking about going back to the they said they've been sold two providers. One was the local provider provided them, and oddly, they had two phone lines, and both of the phone numbers had an 01638 number, is what they had, where the location is. And the number, like they had the telephone number at, you know, like when you put your username password in the ADSL field, it tells you, normally sometimes it's the telephone number at the address. But when I was like tracing the cables back, we only had one of the username and password. We didn't have the password for the second account. I chased the lines back, and they went to the wrong phone line. So if you see what I mean, so I'd said two phone lines coming in, and they each had an ADSL connection, but they should have been from separate providers, or they weren't at work at one point, but they were plugged into the wrong socket, if you see what I mean. So each of the ADSL, I couldn't work out why. And then I realized that they were both TalkTalk customers. They basically, both of the customers the suppliers have been brought by TalkTalk. So with TalkTalk, is it when you connect it up to their network, and obviously it goes back to their DSLAM and their Radius server, you can use any the username password isn't locked down to telephone number. So yeah, so at one point they got resilience. They said, I'd have two separate different broadband providers in case one goes down. But in the end, they were both with TalkTalk in the end. So yeah, that's my first interesting job of the week. So
it would have worked anyway.
Yes. So okay. So that's what I can work out, that they had their numbers. Each of their ADSL accounts had the username, which is something was a telephone number at the provider. Mm. And yeah, and they were both reselling TalkTalk. And what was confusing was that when I traced the cables back, the ADSL was plugged, when the ADSL router is what said, like, oh, this is this supplier, traced the line back, and it was in the wrong ADSL. But because the Radius server goes, what doesn't know where it's coming from, it, yeah.
I mean, for resilience, really, they should have two separate providers, shouldn't they?
They did. Well, that's what they thought when they purted it.
Ah, okay, but they, yeah.
Then TalkTalk brought out both the providers, and they both know broadboard. They're TalkTalk.
What was the what was the original one?
Well, one of them,
the two different ones to begin with.
Well, one of them was actually with Nildram, which was then got brought by TalkTalk.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one is just one of the suppliers we use, which we sold them, which is actually backed off to TalkTalk.
Yeah. I'm surprised that it wasn't like legacy, and they were still on the old, you know, the old network of the original provider. Mm. they've been really efficient at the exchange then. The exchange end, it seems unusual, but yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that's my first job of the week. Anyway, Andy, what have you been up to?
Well, I've had a few. You know, when things come like buses. I've had about two or three sort of major issues with printers this week. I want to say major issues. I mean, they weren't really major issues, but they were to them.
Printers are the IT technicians' arch enemy, I always find it.
Yeah.
It's because they're so mechanical. That's what I put it down to anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I don't literally don't mess about with them at all. If they're not working physically, then I tell them they're knackered. but you know, the communication side is a different thing. But one of them is this big Xerox one, you know, it's a photocopier and printer and everything all in one.
Multifunction.
Yeah. Or something had mechanically gone wrong with it. So the guy had someone came along and picked it up and took it away, and then they fixed it and brought it back again. You probably guess when they brought it back and they plug it all in, it doesn't work, you know, where it did before. So I went along to have a look, and I'm thinking, what have they done here? I thought one of the possibilities was, all the configuration within the printer itself. You know, what if they'd reset all of that or put new boards in or whatever? You know, it's probably lost its static IP address or whatever. So I went and checked it, and it was still the same, exactly the same as what it was before. So I thought, well, they haven't lost that. I think it was on the IP address of 1.50. So I go to a machine, go to a browser, and then do the 1.50. Couldn't find it. So I thought, right, well, it's definitely not connected here. Then I was trying all sorts. Only to find, you know, these, I think it's a BT Hub 5 routers that they give out. Or might have been the 4. On the back of that router, there's there's five Ethernet sockets. Now, four of them are yellow, which is for your normal hub. For your normal computers and that. And one of them is red. And the red one, as if you've got a separate fiber modem. That they did give to people for quite a while. Separate fiber modem, which then outputs on an Ethernet. You then plug it into the BT hub on the red port, and then acts like a bridge modem, I suppose, bridge router. So when eventually found that, I'd realized I'd plugged it into the completely the wrong plug at the back of the router. So it was a bit of a pain. They'd gone all day without being able to use this printer, even though they got it back. They thought there was something up with the printer. And it was all because they'd plugged it into the wrong port on the router again. So that was a bit of a... I was going around everywhere looking for that particular problem. I didn't really think about that until I started tracing all the cables back.
Yeah. My advice is always check the physical networking first.
Yeah.
so many times I've been caught out by that.
Well, I mean, that seems pretty logical. But, of course, where the printer was, it was nowhere near the router. So when the guy would have took the thing away, it had unplugged it, the Ethernet cable, where it was. Unplugged the power, and then the printer's ready to be taken away. You know, then how on earth it's got someone's gone back to the router and unplugged stuff at the router as well? I don't know. That's probably why I didn't look in the first place, because there'd be no need for anybody to do that. But that's what they've done, and off they go. And I've also had various Windows 10 issues this week with. Predominantly with Windows 10 upgrading itself by itself.
Yeah, there's been so much about that on various tech podcasts, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, though, is you can't upgrade it without doing something. You know, I know they're doing a very sly method of doing it, and they're being very kind of, you know, I don't think they're being very good about it one bit. But somebody has to, at minimum, you have to click the end user license agreement in order to put Windows 10 on. At minimum, you have to say, I agree, you see. And if you do, I disagree, it won't install Windows 10. So you have to do that at absolute minimum. So, and a lot of people have said, oh, it's installed and I didn't do anything. I just switched it on one day and there it was. But you still have the option, the choice not to do it. Most of the time,
I think people don't see
them. They don't read it.
I think people just, people just automatically click agree on boxes like that.
Yeah, that's true.
Because of years of conditioning. And when it's something like, the latest thing is, you know, the box comes up and it's got an X and you click the X. And by clicking the X, it starts installing.
Yeah.
And people just click it without thinking, I think.
France has scored in the 89th minute.
Oh, good. There you go. Just to let everyone else know, apart from doing this podcast, we're also watching the first game of the Euros, which is France.
Bad luck, Romania.
So there's 2 minutes to go and France are 2-1 up.
Yeah, well, I had a funny thing with Windows 10 is that someone at work, we didn't do it. It's basically, you know, it pushed all the license. Basically, with some of the stuff, you can tell it what updates to install. And we were just doing security and critical patches. But someone changed it to recommended updates.
All right.
And that recommended updates puts in the Windows 10 thing, the GXW thing. And if you're not careful, what you can do is that you can tick the box what says, do you want to install Windows now or later or cancel or something? And if you do, as Jerry was saying, if you click this X, it means that you want to install it. And then the next time the box comes up, it says, do you want to install Windows 10 now or reschedule it? And there's no way of getting, once you've gone to that file, there's no way of getting past that window. It will install Windows 10. So I haven't seen what the box looks like before that, but I have seen the box where it says, install Windows 10 now or schedule later, because I got past the call. And there was no way of working out how to get past that bit without going forward to Windows 10 and then taking it off again.
Have you heard of, have you been listening to Steve Gibson? He's got this little utility that he's written.
Never 10.
Called Never 10, yeah.
Yeah, well, that basically prevents the install going on, but it doesn't prevent the next bit. You can use that to get rid of the 6 gig download file, but then in the background, it will then start downloading it again.
Yeah, I was going to ask, actually, because I've been using, I know about that Never 10. I've been using the GWX control panel that you can download. But the question I was going to have is, on a domain server and that, how do you manage that? You know, is that just down to the critical updates only, is it, like you said? Is that how you manage?
Yeah, so we're
not doing it.
Yeah, I haven't seen. Yeah, you basically, like, if you're doing WSUS stuff, you will. I haven't seen the GX, the little Windows on Windows 7 machines. I haven't seen the little, you know, like you get the little flaggy thing when it comes, like a Windows upgrade thing. Yeah. On a domain joined PC, I haven't seen that come down. I've only ever seen it on home PCs. So if you're running WSUS, you then choose what updates to go out, and then you can choose which updates to go to, and obviously you won't push that one what pushes W10 down.
Yeah, I don't think they'd be doing it in businesses, because there'd just be an outcry, you know. You'd have multiple Linux, Ubuntu installations and companies and things. If IT departments of companies caught you trying to change software on their PCs like that,
I don't know if it works with volume license. So you get Windows 7, you get the OEM. I think if you've got an OEM license, you get a free upgrade. I don't know what the volume license key agreement is, if you know what I mean. So figuring that now as we speak.
I mean, I've never used it, but apparently Windows 10 in itself isn't a bad OS.
But I've run it. It's brilliant. I love it. I've been running it on my desktop for the last, wasn't, I started my new job, which is 9 months kind of thing. So it's brilliant.
Some of the old apps they're using to get it on people's machines. Yeah. There's going to be a backlash, isn't it?
It's a tactics, rather. I think it's fine, yeah. We're also not sure about the possible. I've heard about things about having adverts on it and things like that. And because I don't know about you, but I do get little Windows adverts quite regular on Windows 10, with little boxes popping up at the bottom, you know, saying get Windows 365, get Office 365, and things like this. And using it as an advertising platform. So.
I don't get that. I mean, my daughter's got Windows 8.1. She hasn't complained about it, put it that way. I haven't had a support request for her about it. But, yeah. I wanted to get the SSD on there before upgrading it to Windows 10, but, yeah.
Well, it's fine, because you can upgrade to Windows 10, and you can just do a fresh install of Windows 10. And you don't have to put the key in, because it logs it kind of registers it in the it does look at your machine and generates a key kind of thing, so that whenever you install it, again, you don't have to put the key in. It basically goes to the internet and looks at your key and then says you're eligible for Windows 10.
Right.
Did they go on a motherboard? I don't know exactly what, like a motherboard serial number or something like that.
Yeah.
And it registers that key with that either MAC address or serial number.
Yeah, it does something clever in the background, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Probably just creates a hash from, like you say, the MAC address and serial numbers and things like that.
So something unique.
A unique identifier.
I mean, that makes things a lot easier if you do have to reinstall, especially if you don't know the key. Which I had. I mean, that's actually another one I forgot about a couple of weeks ago, somebody's hard drive had gone down, a Windows 7 laptop, hard drive is completely knackered, so I had to put a new drive in, reinstall Windows 7, and of course you have to type in the key. And it's one of these situations where the sticker on the bottom and the key had worn off, so you couldn't actually read what the product key was. So that is then a bit of a problem, because you've got no idea what the product key is, and you can't read the product key, and that's it, you're stuck. But on Windows 10, once it's registered for life on that motherboard. And of course, what it does do as well is it keeps you, because that's what the license says, it keeps that product key on that, motherboard, if you like. So,
which
you
would
can't
become
then
a,
get another, you know, get another motherboard and reinstall it on another motherboard.
Which would become a problem when you change a bit of hardware. So, you know, and the network card, not that you would change the network card these days, when one of those things changes, the UID will probably change as well. That UID will change, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay for changing minor things in Windows generally, but it's when you change something major or you change several major things. So say you changed a hard drive 1 week. No problem. Say you change a graphics card the week after, no problem. But then say you change something else another week after. That's when they start to say, hang on a minute, this is now turning into a completely different computer now. And that's where you have to reactivate again.
Do you start to find Microsoft to sort it out, or is it just a fill in a form or something?
If it's most of the time, it gives you a unique ID on the screen of the activation screen, and you can phone them up and type that number in on the phone, and then they give you a number back again, and it reactivates.
Right.
Most of the time, you can, if you get stuck with something, you can speak to somebody.
Enter the fourth set of letters. Now enter the five enter letters. Now enter the...
Sounds like you're speaking from experience there, Al.
It's a painstaking process, isn't it?
Enter 1, 2, 3, 4. Press 1 to go to the next section. Hash key to...
So you get to phone a computer and speak to a computer, basically.
Yeah, basically. Like sometimes, if you're activating like a number of Office licenses or something, some of the Office you get now, you get like a little CD card. You don't even get any media anymore, and you have to register that with an email address. And if you're doing that from one public IP address, and you do like 10 laptops. The first two work fine with the internet activation fine, then the third one you have to sit there and phone up, and then the next two work fine, and then you have to phone up for the like you can do a certain amount, and then it just
Microsoft, if you're listening, please fix.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully with this newer Windows 10 activation idea that prevents all of that. So that would be helpful.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to then, Jerry?
I've been learning a bit more Python now.
Really?
I promised that I would on the last episode. Listeners might be getting bored of me mentioning this book, Automate the Boring Stuff, but I'm working my way through it. I'm now onto dictionaries, which are kind of like arrays, but unordered. In Python, they're called lists. So a list is like a series of things. It could be strings or integers or whatever. And they're in a sequence, so you can refer to the first one, the second one, the third one. Dictionaries are unordered, so you have key value pairs. So for instance, I think I might have to find the page in my book that I'm learning it from. Something like okay, we've got imagine you're playing a D&D game, and you've got an inventory, and you've got a name of something and how many of them you've got. So you've got one rope, you've got six torches, you've got 42 gold coins, you've got one dagger and 12 arrows. So in that sense, rope would be one, torch would be six, gold coin would be 42, dagger would be one, arrow would be 12. And that you can store that as a what's called a dictionary in Python, and you can do fun things with it. You can refer to that in bits of code, print out certain bits. You can print out the just the values or just the keys or whatever you want to do. So that's what I'm up to at the moment. And there's an exercise at the end of each chapter, and I'm just working my way through that about how to do a D&D inventory, basically.
All right.
So yeah, that's a nice bit of Python there. At my day job, I've been having fun with Jenkins. I don't know if I mentioned Jenkins before on the podcast, but it's what it basically is a build server. So it runs jobs to build the software, which is then deployed onto your infrastructure. And the task that I've got at the moment is, have we done version control before? Have we done
Yeah.
Git? I can't remember. So my where I work, they use Git, and what they want to be able to do is they want to be able to branch, have as many branches as they want. So you take a bit of code, and when you branch it, you basically make a copy of it. And you can make changes in that branch, and then when you're happy with what you got, you can merge that back into the main line or whatever. So what they want to be able to do is branch the code, change it, and then deploy that code to a bit of test infrastructure. So my task is to make that possible. At the moment, we have got three sort of main branches. We've got QA, staging, and production. Production is obviously what the general public sees. QA is stuff that we're sort of testing out, and staging. It's actually the same as QA now, but staging is supposed to be it goes there before it goes into production, and any sort of last minute problems are weeded out. But what they will be able to do is to make a branch to just test something out, and then be able to deploy that to a bit of infrastructure that isn't public facing or isn't necessarily public facing, and just have that be possible. Jenkins itself doesn't make this very easy. In older versions, but they've got a new plugin basically, which should allow this. But the only problem with that is I've got to work out how to implement it. Mm-hmm. So it's a work in progress. It's using the pipeline plugin. Again, as I always say, I'm going to have to come back and talk about it in a later episode, but I'm kind of in the middle of that at the moment. So, so that's what I've been working on.
So does Jenkins compile the code then? So you're writing your code and then it compiles it to what it needs to be, kind of thing?
It basically does whatever you tell it to. You can tell it to run shell scripts, or you can use these kind of build tools. It's written Java, so I mean, one of the things with Java, one of the build tools is called Maven, and that's seems to be a big thing that people use it for compiling Java code. Mm-hmm. So you can do that, or you can there's loads of plugins, so you can do things like tell it to fire up a Docker container and build the code in there. Our build tool at work does that. It's separate. It's kind of it's not within Jenkins, but mm-hmm. It goes off and does that. Runs loads of tests on the code to make sure it passes. This is part of test-driven development. So the developer writes the code, but writes a load of tests that have to pass before it can be considered to be a successful build. So it does that, and it will package it builds it to Debian packages. That's the way our pipeline works. Builds it to a Debian package, and then when we deploy the code, it's done by just apt-get install, basically.
Yeah.
That's how the code is deployed to the infrastructure. So I'm just trying to work out this step of getting it to build all these different branches. So, I mean, in the normal course of things, someone would all the code is on GitHub, so someone would do something, test as much as they could, and then they would merge the branch into QA on GitHub, push that out to GitHub. Jenkins would see that there's something that's been pushed to QA, and then build a package which would go to the QA machines. And then when that's all built, you do apt-get install on the QA machine, and the code goes onto the QA machine. That's how the code's deployed. But what we want to achieve is you just have, you know, dollar feature branch, and that gets built, and then you can change the infrastructure. I've already worked this bit out. You can change the machines to say install everything on feature branch, and just have that installed. So you can deploy code basically anywhere you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's just this little bit in the middle to work out, which is Jenkins. that's kind of what I've been up to in my day job. In terms of freelance work, that's getting a bit interesting now, because one of my clients is moving over from One and One, which was their old hosting provider. They're a load of dedicated servers there, to some VMware-based VMs. So there's a load of building up of servers to be done there. And they're using Veeam for backups, mm-hmm. which I know you've talked about in the past, Al. Being a VMware man. So that's what they're going to be using for backups, mm-hmm. and going forward, you know, just backing up the whole VM.
Yeah.
I'd quite like to get something in there to just back up the actual data as well,
mm-hmm.
As a kind of a separate thing.
Yeah, it's always good to have that application backup as well.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm going to move that, because they've got, this is another thing probably to talk about in terms of the kind of field that I'm working in, and the freelance stuff. At the moment, they've got AMP servers, so Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP. So the web server and the database server is running on the same machine. And to start off with, I'm going to migrate them to new machines with the web server and MySQL server running on the same machine. But eventually what I want to achieve is to have the web servers just doing the web serving, having a separate database server, which they go back to, and having a separate mail server, separate backup server. So basically decoupling everything, so it's all sitting on different virtual machines. Because that just seems architecturally, it just seems a better way to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to migrate them as they are at the moment to the new VMs, and then at a later date change them over to this decoupled infrastructure kind of idea. And then I've got another client who want to. I might have talked about them in the past. It's my oldest client. They've got a Agios Centrion, which is I don't know if anyone's heard of that really. It's another LAMP application, Apache MySQL PHP, which runs over Nagios. So it uses Nagios, and then it has its own front, which is a web app. But the reason that I put them onto that was because it does distributed monitoring quite well. But their main requirement is to move over to a new system. So they've got in touch with Nagios, the company, and they're paid for Nagios XI, which seems to be like a do-over of their open source product, which might have a nicer front end. I mean, what they need is a GUI that they can configure all the stuff in, because configuration in the source product is all through text files, and it's not very friendly. Speaking from experience here.
Yeah, Nagios XI is a commercial product. So Nagios write the open source with all URLs, but how they make their money is through Nagios XI.
So I've never used it. I've only ever used the open source one, being a cheapskate. So I've got to get a proof of concept running with that. And also the other one is iSinger, which is may have talked about that as well.
You mentioned it last week.
Yeah. So the original, just to recap, the original iSinger was a kind of a reskinning of Nagios, but they in version 2 they've completely rewritten it. I'd like to see them go onto that one personally, because I've heard many things about Nagios. It's great. It's the industry standard, and it has been, but it has been for like 10 years. There are better solutions out there. I think iSinger might be one of them, but yeah, I'd like to give it a try anyway. But the thing with these monitoring systems is you need an infrastructure. You need a full infrastructure to try it out on, and I haven't got one of those. My clients have. So. best to try it there, really.
Cool.
So that's me for my my stuff that's going on.
I had a rogue DHCP server to deal with this week. We had a customer phone up saying that slowly all their PCs were losing internet and their phones were dying because they were VoIP phones. And I got dispatched to have a look, because this customers are actually moving to a new site next week or this weekend. And there's these people who heard me talk to about before. They've got a Linux firewall with a Shure wall installed in it. And it's really, the config's really hard to read. Unless it's like one of those things you do in the app that you probably understand it. But it's a so old version of it. It doesn't look like documentation. And it took me about half an hour getting it to actually work out what happened. Is that when you were on the network, no one was getting an IP address. But if you gave yourself a static IP address, you can get access out to the internet, okay? So what has happened is it looks like someone had brought a laptop in with a DHCP server on it, and the DHCP server on the router had shut down. So it detected the DHCP server, all right, obviously you're in control, and it shut down. As soon as I started this DHCP server, the phone's got its IP addresses again. So I can only think, the only way I can think of why the DHCP server stopped, unless it crashed or something. But
was it a Windows DHCP server?
No, it was on a Linux box on the Linux router.
Because I don't think there's any kind of protocol to tell a DHCP server to shut down.
All right.
I think in Windows you've got the kind of the authorized DHCP servers, don't you?
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anything like that in Linux, as far as I know. Could be wrong, but
yeah. But yeah, so
it could just be that the process died.
Could be. But I wasn't going to spend waste time trying to work it out. But to start it, you had to do some odd command. It was like the start service, and then it was like something. It wasn't like start service DHCPD. It was something else random which I'd never heard of before, like ISC-D-DHCP-server or something. But we're putting a new ASA in on the new site, and we're putting DHCP on the Windows box. So it's all flat network. They don't need all these multiple network VLANs. So yes, we'll have full control of the network, which will be good. So interesting. Also did an EFM upgrade this week to one of our customers. All they could get before was a something like an 8 meg connection down and then a half a meg up. And that's all they couldn't. They couldn't get FTTC there. And they were running these RDP clients, and it was just really rubbish. So we basically sold them this EFM product, which is Ethernet First Mile. I don't know if you ever come across that before. It's where you combine the lines. So they basically, BT provide you with four pairs of lines. And because TalkTalk have got local LLU, can you remember that in the old days of when you be the old broadband providers used to put their own DSLAMs into the cabinets, and then they used basically
local loop unbundling, wasn't it?
Yeah. So basically they can then combine the four pairs, and you can get 20 meg up and 20 meg down over this Ethernet First Mile. So you have to have this router. I'll put a link into the thing. You get like a little EFM box, EFM DSL modem, and it's a little box, and that basically terminates it, and then you put your router on the other end of it, and you get given a public IP address and what the router IP address is, and the WAN IP, and you get a 20 meg up, 20 meg down for like not the price of a later line kind of thing. There's no guarantee on the SLA on it kind of thing. So is it
still potentially copper for that first mile?
It's copper basically. It's four pairs of copper. So you can either have two links. I'll put a link in the chat. You can see how it works. You basically have four links, four copper lines back.
So it's not really Ethernet.
No, but that's what they call it.
Technically speaking.
No, it's Ethernet First Mile. Basically, they.
What is it in an Ethernet cable? It's something like eight different cables, isn't it? Or
depends if you're duplexing or not. Yeah, it depends if you're duplexing, isn't it? So.
Yeah.
And then you might be able to help me out with this one and the other. I mean, sorry, Joe, about SSL tunneling. I didn't know this. Again, one of our customers, we've been given access to their AWS environment. And it's one of those things, unless you do it for the first time, you know about it. So we got given this. So we had to basically give our public IP address so that they can add it into their firewall so we get into their first host. And now I've got this thing called a Bastion host? BASTION host?
Yeah. What this is it's basically the Bastion host has got a public IP address, and then it's talking to hosts behind it that have got a private IP address. So you can think of it as a VLAN.
Yeah.
But a private VLAN. And that's basically when you hear someone talking about a bastion house, that's what it is. Sometimes it's called a jump box as well, apparently.
So
and the reason they do that is because IPs cost money, and if you can only use one IP, then you know it's cheaper.
So I had to provide them with my SSH key, my public. Yeah, so I basically generated a private key and a public key using PuTTY, because obviously I don't really have a Linux box to, like, on my desktop. So I use PuTTY. There's a thing called PuTTY key gem, which basically creates you a public and private key, and you can basically put a password on that. And they basically wanted our private, sorry, our public key. So I gave them a copy of our public key. They put that on the on that host into their trust, into their SS. Yeah, into my logon, so that when I log in...
So that'd be the authorized key, the .ssh/authorized keys file.
Yeah, into my login username, for our customer. So that was fine. And then obviously, within PuTTY on the Windows, you can basically say the public IP address and your username, and you tell it where your PuTTY key is, as a .ppk file. So... when you then connect, when you load up PuTTY and you connect to that thing, because in PuTTY you can save connections, you connect to it, it's fine. Ask you for the private key, the passphrase private key, brute, and I could get into that host. But the guy who'd emailed me at the thing said, he didn't kind of really explain it kind of thing, and he thought I was using an Linux box to connect to it, but I wasn't obviously using a Windows box. And he'd basically... didn't give me any details of how to connect to the servers and remotely inside it. And it gave me these lists of files, what in the ssh.ssh/config file. And he gave me, I didn't notice it, but he had given my boss their private key for their internal servers. So I saw that once I got onto that box, like in the past, I've had it where like you have an RDP box and you RDP onto that box, and then from that box you then go into it. But no, what he wanted me to do was that on my, he saw I had a window, a Linux box. So what I did was I created a Linux box in our office on our Hyper-V server, which you basically SSH onto it internally, and then you put your private keys, what he'd given me, into your .ssh folder. And then in your config file, you can put a load of stuff in there. Config. I don't know, you can do this. But you basically you put host, and then you put the server name of like a nickname. You then put the user you're connecting to it. Then you put a path to your SSH key in it. And then you can also do a thing called a proxy command where you tell it to SSH onto another onto the bastion host, and then the IP address of the server inside it. So you can type in SSH space LDAP server from the actual Ubuntu server internally. And what that does is that passes SSH tunnels, so that then connects you from your PC. So you're connecting from your PC to my host, and then from that host you're SSL tunneling from your host to the bastion host, and then it's forwarding your bastion host to the thing, so you don't know that you're jumping through it. So you look like you're thinking that you're on the machine. So I didn't know you could do that, but I do now, obviously, kind of thing. So
you can actually do that directly with PuTTY as well. There's a SSH tunneling thing in the configuration.
All right, okay.
You can set up tunnels there. I don't know if you can do proxy command there, because I haven't used it for a long time. But yeah, it's definitely a possibility. And I use tunnels quite a lot. I don't know if we've done it before on the podcast, but yeah, basically if you get an SSH to a box, you can then forward a port from the remote box to your box, and then connect to that box on your local box as if it were a local port. So yes, really handy sometimes. And it, for hopping onto networks, it's handy as well.
Yeah. So what I mean, a lot of the time, I
don't bother with that. I just hop onto the box, SSH, copy from, you know, somewhere inside the private network, and then just copy it back, just because. Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing as well, obviously, they give. Yeah. The thing to me, I forgot that they give me the key, and with it, and all annoyingly, I made my key with PuTTY, this PuTTY keygen, but you can export the certificate to an open SSL key, and then you can put then SSH onto the box and then copy my key over. But then when I tried to run the command, so you can do SSH LDAP, it came up the big warning going, warning, unprotected private key file. Permission 0744 for the home file is open. So I didn't realise that you have to change permission to 600.
Yeah, you've got to change the private key to 0600, and you've got to make sure the .ssh directory is 0700. I think you can make it a little bit more relaxed than that, but yeah.
But I'll put a link in the show notes to How to Geek, which showed you how to do it. So
also, a bit of a pro tip here: your authorized keys file. If you're having problems with logging into something with SSH keys, check the permissions of the authorized key file and also the .ssh directory on the destination, because if that's too open, it won't do it and it won't tell you. You have to go looking in the logs for why it isn't working, because it won't tell you on the command prompt. So, and also, I noticed you said SSL earlier, Al, and it's SSH. Open. Sorry. SSH, not SSL is the same but different. It uses public key, but it uses it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, and open SSH. Yeah. So, yeah.
Not to be confused.
Yeah, but now I know about SSL tunneling. I know that, but he'd written it and say, oh,
SSH tunneling.
SSH tunneling, sorry, yeah. It's getting late. So,
it's very handy, and I've used it quite a lot. I mean, I use it for I've got an RDP server running on my local network, but it's not forwarded to the outside world, so I SSH into my home network and then forward the RDP port over SSH, so yep. It's all secure.
Yeah, well, I was looking at maybe I'll add in my SSH to my Linux machine, I can just edit the file so that I can just go open SSH into my virtual machine and my BPS or whatever, and you haven't got to worry about typing anything because it just knows it kind of thing. So.
And you could also use that for AWS, like say you've got an RDP server on AWS, you can have it completely secure. Well, not, nothing's completely secure, but you can have it behind SSH and all the traffic's encrypted. So.
Yeah, so
it's great. It's really well.
Yeah, and at least I know now, and I understand a bit more about SSL tunneling and stuff, and how cool it is. So
SSH tunneling.
SSH tunneling. Sorry. The other thing is about adding interesting today. With Opus 365, you can let's say you've got a photocopier or something on a network, and you want it to print. You want it to like send a scan to it, also. If you scan something and it emails you, kind of thing. If we do Office 365, you'd need an SMTP server for it to send it out. Normally, if you had like an on-site exchange, you'd configure it to go to your exchange server. But with Office 365, you have to go into the Office 365 portal. And I'll put a link in the show notes how it is, but you have to add the public IP address of your network where the photocopy is sitting. So it knows that if it comes from this IP address, it will send it. It knows where it's coming from. It knows it's actually trusted. It's not like a spamming or whatever. So it's not like an open relay. But annoyingly today, we had a customer phone up about the SMTP. Well, they're setting up a new HR system, and they wanted an SMTP server so they could email all the employees when they run the payroll or whatever. But the problem we had is that when you do set this SMTP server up for the server, it will ask you for the server name. And in Office 365, it will be something like your domain name .mailprotection.outlook.com. So it'll be like a string of letters and it'll be a DNS name. And a normal most things you can put a DNS name, but this application you couldn't put a DNS name in. It has to be an IP address. And obviously you could obviously ping the domain name, but that would come back as an IP address. But obviously Microsoft could change that in the future, and then it will fail.
It depends on reverse lookup as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Whether the reverse DNS lookup is set correctly.
Yeah. So there's a website you can go to called httpssender.office.com, because sometimes you could even set this all up correctly and still Microsoft will still block it because someone's been like bad spamming IP addresses or whatever, or that IP address has got like someone's got a virus on the network. Microsoft might block that IP address. So have a look at sender.office.com, and you basically put the IP address in the way you're trying to send from and your email address, and it'll put one of those really annoying character thingies to look at, which with 8 characters, it sometimes you can't really have to press a little play button to play the sound. It will then send you a link to click on. You click on the link, and then it will go back to the question. It will tell you if the IP address is on the list or not, and luckily my one wasn't. So with IIS, what I did was, in the end, to get around this, it already had IIS stored in the server because this application was using IIS. But you do, in Windows, you can install SNTP server on the server. So you have to install the IIS 6 compatibility things. And what that does is, when you go to add features, you add SNTP server. And what you can do is that you can tell it that server is an SNTP server. So it'll be listening on port 25. And you then basically set the relay up. So I basically set the relay up so that only itself could send email from it. So even if someone tried to spam it, like if someone had a virus or something that tried to send emails through that IP address, it wouldn't let you. And then what you do is you put a SMTP, I think it's like a, you then tell it where to forward the mail to. And in the configuration, you tell it that any, if you receive an email on it, forward it to the Microsoft address. So that means that, If you say the IP address is 192.168.0.25, so if you, we told them to put their settings as that, when they go to send the mail gets sent to the local server, and then the SNTP server then forwards it to Office 365. So that's what you do, and that basically so it basically relays the SNTP. But when I set this up, it still wasn't working. So you can manually test SMTP transfer by using the telnet command. I can't ever remember what the commands are to send emails by, like the telnet or whatever.
The first one is hello, H-E-L-O.
Yeah.
And then the host name, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a very wordy protocol, so you can literally type it in and get the responses that you want.
I'll put a link in the show notes how to set this SMTP up. So it basically means in their software could put 192.168.0.25, and then it would send it to itself, and then it would forward it to the Office 365, and it worked, which is good. But a lot of the 2012 servers these days doesn't have Telnet client installed by default, which is annoying. So you can install it, but quick and easier way is just download PuTTY. And you can put the IP address in, and you just change, you click on Telnet, and you just tell it the port normally says 22, but you change it to 25, and then you connect it. But I always use a nice little utility I've used in the past. I'll put a link in the show notes to this, called SMTP Dialog Tool. And basically, well, that's just the graphical version of that. So you install it, it comes up with a box. You put your sender name, the to name, your subject, and your address, and you click and you put the IP address of the SMTP server, click on test, and it brings up the box and it shows you what's happening on the SMTP command, and then it shows you it going through the process and it says if the message is delivered or not. And yeah, it all worked. So
this will all be a lot easier once the Ubuntu user space is on Windows. You'll have a Telnet client and an SSH client now.
Yeah.
It's going to put PuTTY out of business. Not that they're in business. But
I mean, when's the last update for Putty? I wonder how many times that gets downloaded a day. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
they should at least put some, like, put an advert on the site. Probably make some money.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, how long? Yeah.
I mean, Putty's also good for serial connections as well.
Yes.
You know, if you don't, like, Hyperterm must be, you know, 20 years old or.
Well, it's not included anymore anyway, so.
Hasn't it? Okay, yeah.
It hasn't been included since Windows XP, I don't think.
Right.
But, like, on Monday when I was at that site with the Bic Rand in the circle, with this server, this firewall which wouldn't reboot, it had a serial put on the back of it. So I connected that to my serial laptop, loaded up Putty, clicked on the serial, put COM1 in. Surprisingly, my laptop's actually got a COM port. What I love about my laptop is that you just COM1, return, nothing coming back. It connected, but you could see it booting, and then it just, like, failed halfway through booting of the image. So, all good. So my throat's starting to hurt now after all that talking and stuff.
Must be time to end the show.
Yeah. I've got nothing else to say anymore.
All I would like to say is don't forget to look at our social media outlets, because we always forget to say that. So. and also mail admin@adminpodcast.co.uk if you want to get in touch.
Yeah, we haven't had an email. We haven't had an email today, have we?
No, not this. Not this cycle.
Great. Well, we're a bit over the hour anyway, so.
Yeah.
I guess that's
it. Oh, I should mention, actually, we did get a shout out on the SysAdmin's Trivia podcast.
Did we?
It was not the last one, but the one before.
Okay.
So that's all good.
Cool.
That sounds good.
Okay, we'll speak to everyone soon then.
Yeah, we'll see you next time.
See you later.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.